Now back to The People's Show with Seth, Dan, and Randeep on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
The text line's still buzzing about Blundstones. Couples who wear the same color Blundstones and wear North Face jackets. Hashtag Vancouver.
Yeah. The North Face jacket I can get with. I got a couple of those.
Yeah. Oh, so if you have it, then it's a real Vancouver thing.
No, I just said I can get with that trend.
I see how this works.
I'm not as arrogant as you are saying, I have something, so therefore it's a Vancouver thing. Get out of here.
Yeah. Still, my favorite thing about the pre-show meeting today was Randeep ripping on Blundstones and then being like, I think I actually have a pair in my closet.
I was so mad when he said that.
But that proves my point, that I don't even know what they are. So I thought I had them, but I don't.
You don't.
I don't.
And they're not cheap boots.
No.
So, like, for you to think you had them, it's like, how many? This is a guy with a $500 sweater, though.
Yeah, it's true.
I like nice things in life. All right.
They are durable.
I don't apologize for it.
All right. It's the People Show. Keep the text coming in. 650 on the Dunbar Lumber text line.
Just a couple. Can we hit a couple real quick?
All right, let's hit a couple more.
Not saying Dan is fashion illiterate. Just saying he isn't a fashionista. That's one.
That's pretty good.
Not saying I'm not culturally ignorant. I'm just saying I thought Timbaland created Timberland shoes. The artist.
There's one that is a producer of music. There is the other that is a shoe.
Yep.
Yeah. Torgi's saying, I pulled out my all-white Monarchs today. It's a beautiful day.
Exactly.
Flex it, man.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Wear your nice white sneakers on a day like today.
And Travis Green texted. It's not actually Travis Green, but Travis Green texted. I'm not saying Jim should take over public relations when we get a new GM. I'm just saying, Benny in quotes, to take pressure off the coaching staff.
It's pretty good. The text line is always bringing laughs on the People's Show. It is Sportsnet 650. Canucks get the Penguins on Saturday. We'll keep getting you ready for that. Brian Burke going to join us tomorrow on the show. Adnan Verk is going to join us in a couple of moments here as he joins us every week. Major League Baseball, after a flurry of spending from teams across the league, including Max Scherzer getting the or setting a new record for the highest average annual salary at over $40 million per, and raising that bar by 20%, Major League owners have all of a sudden locked out their players. The collective bargaining agreement expired at midnight this past morning, and now a lockout has halted all baseball activities. And I do get, I kind of chuckle at the idea of, well, this sport can't afford a lockout. I've been there before. I've said those types of things before. At the same time, every time we've said that, especially in the NHL, we've said that, where the league that's had the most lockouts recently, or strikes, it hasn't really rung true. The leagues have always come back stronger than they did the time before. Maybe not initially, but eventually sports have been just trending up and there's not really much you can do to stop them. And I think that really has beholden a lot of owners to be like, all right, we're going to benefit from this no matter what.
Well, and it's interesting because in every other sport, lockouts have happened and it hasn't hurt the sport. The sport has actually grown after every single lockout, which is incredible. And it kind of tells you that when you see corporations, and this is what these leagues are, they're just corporations. And what do corporations look at? Bottom line. And how do you get to maximize your bottom line? And when you see that the NHL lost an entire season, came back stronger than ever, they've had lockouts since then, and they've come back and still made more revenue. The NBA, you've seen what's happened with the lockouts they've had. And the NFL hasn't missed regular season games, but they missed preseason games. And they're still benefiting after going through their labor strife. Baseball's largely avoided that out of their fear of fans not coming back, which is what happened in the 90s during the year. That's the year the Expos were so good, they probably would have won the World Series. And the lockout happened in season. The year was lost. There was no champion that year. Baseball fans swore off baseball. A lot of people didn't come back after that. And since then, baseball has been spooked about doing this. But I think this is just showing you that ultimately, the greed is going to win over. And the leagues look at this and say, why are we playing nice?
Yeah.
Because if we put our foot down, we're going to benefit. And there's not going to be the backlash we think there's going to be. Because the fans that were here in the mid-90s is 25 years ago. There's a new generation. People look at this differently.
It would be, it is now actually, the ninth work stoppage that baseball has ever had, right? Yeah. Which you're
first,
right.
First since the mid-90s.
Yeah. It's multi-generational, right? So this is where, you know, the disconnect is there. Like if you're a fan 20 years ago, you may or may not remember it. There's a good size of the population that doesn't because they're younger. But it is something that I think baseball is in a different spot than the NFL was during that preseason, during, you know, different than hockey as well. It's a sport that is, to a certain degree, looking for some answers as well about that next generation, the marketable faces. We talk about the business side and the connect with the fan base. So I think there is something to be lost here. The question is it long term?
Yeah.
Does it linger with fans? And as the answer we've seen, generally it doesn't.
Let's bring in Adnan Virk, NHL and MLB Network. Thanks for this, Adnan. It's we're just discussing, you know, the idea, the notion that, you know, this sport can't afford a lockout. You know, whether it's baseball, we've had that conversation with hockey in recent years, but it doesn't feel like that really rings true because these sports end up generating more revenue than they ever had eventually as time goes on.
Yeah, and it's such a funny thing, Dan. People go, they can't do this. But, yeah, of course they can. I mean, they can do whatever the hell they want. Like, guys like me who are diehard baseball fans who the sport can be gone for 5 years and be back. Like, okay, great. Yankees, Jays, 105, I'm in. But I do think you guys are right to the respect that you don't want to take fans' passion and loyalty for granted. There are certainly some fans right now who are frustrated and going, are you kidding? In the midst of COVID, in the midst of these tough economic times, you guys are having a lockout. But the big difference I really do think is that we're not missing games yet. So, I mean, ardent baseball fans are frustrated right now because next week is the winter meetings, and it's normally a fun time for wheeling and dealing. But most people are going to focus on the NFL and the NBA and NHL and move on. And as we all know, December 1st is always a soft deadline, meaning what's really at stake. So what's really going to get where it's interesting is when we get to February. That's when the pressure will start to mount. And as my man Mad Dog Russo said to me today on MLB Network, and by the way, I'd like to have all three of you do a show during a lockout. That was another achievement in my career. You can't show any video of any player. So we're talking about Marcus Stroman signing with the Cubs, but you can't show any video. So it's just like stills. It's like graphics of these people. It's crazy. Anyways, Mad Dog said to me, if you want to know when this thing gets done, it'll be done the day after the Super Bowl, which is Valentine's Day, or March 4th. Like in between that window. That'll be 3 weeks. The biggest thing that I found out today, guys, from working with Tom Verducci and John Heyman and all our great baseball insiders is that the players don't get paid right now anyways. And I said, do you get paid in spring training? They said, no, you get a per diem. And I said, do the owners make money in spring training? They said, a little bit, but imagine if there's 4,000 fans in Dunedin. That's not like 40,000 fans at Rogers Center. So once I heard that, I would have said to you guys, hey, February 1st, we'll figure this out. 2 months, you know, have a nice vacation. But now I'm like, this thing could go into March. But once you start missing checks, that's where things get dicey. So it's upsetting. It's disappointing as a baseball lover and a baseball fan, but here's the optimism. Baseball hasn't had a work stoppage in 26 years. That's remarkable. In that time, NHL had two lockouts, the NBA had two lockouts, the NFL has had a lockout. So one might say this was inevitable, and it certainly was not unexpected. And if they can try to find a way to bridge the gap, and as my parents, who are not sportsmen, said to me, what is this all about? I said, what do you think it's all about? It's about money. It's about free agency and arbitration and divvying up the pie. But as we just saw, guys, there's a lot of money in the sport. I mean, for God's sakes, $1.6 billion was spent on free agents. We're on pace to shatter the $2.3 billion record with total projected free agent spending of $3 billion. The money's there. It's just a matter of divvying up the pie.
Well, the question, too, though, is are they going to miss games at any point? Because all I keep hearing when I'm reading up on this stuff or listening to, you know, insiders talk about this is that for the most part, there isn't really a fear of games being missed. But obviously, at some point, that's going to be threatened. Do you think that we are going to see the schedule affected in any way? Do we see spring training affected at some point? Because we even with spring training, we saw when the players came back after the pandemic and had a shorter ramp up to the season, so many injuries happened. Like it's also a really dicey situation as far as starting the season and making sure everybody can get to the start of the season, doing everything they need to do as well.
It's an excellent point, Sat, about the injuries. You're right about that. But what do you hear most players say? Spring training is too long anyways. So 6 weeks isn't necessary. You know, pitchers and catchers report it's like poetry to guys like me. But people aren't really locked in until March, and then March Madness is on. And, of course, you know, we're hockey fans, et cetera. Like, my point is, it's great to have baseball back, but people aren't really diving in until we get into mid-March, and then we start routing in a farm, they break camp, and, of course, the regular season begins. However, you are totally right to point out, you can't just sign a deal March 4th and just start playing baseball the next day. I think you need 2 weeks from when the deal is signed to ramp up. The guys might be in Cabos, they're on vacation, whatever. They're doing their own workouts, they're not really ready. By the way, there's still a bunch of free agents who have not signed. Clayton Kershaw, Kenley Jansen, Carlos Correa, Trevor Story. So I think, let's suppose the deal gets done March 1st. Okay, we're going to need 2 weeks for all these guys to sign. And by the way, I mentioned the Stars. There's a ton of mid-tier guys who have yet to sign. It's been so cool, amazing to see Seager and Semien and Gausman get signed and Scherzer, but there's a lot still to be done. So let's say March 1st, 2 weeks, let's do 2 weeks of free agency. Then we're going to need, to your point, at risk of injury, 3 weeks to get ramped up, minimum. So technically, I think you're going to get a deal done March 1, and you push that 5 weeks, 2 weeks free agency, 3 weeks spring training. You start the season April 7th, April 8th, and you can still jam-pack in 162. But that's a good point you make. You can't; these guys are not robots. You can't just flip the switch here. There was so much concern this year about pitchers being hurt. You want to avoid that scenario as best as possible.
Anytime we talk about labor negotiations or a lockout or a strike, it always comes down to the egos at play here as well, whether it's the head of the union, the commissioner. When we talk about animosity, Adnan, how much is there between these two parties?
I don't think there's much as you might think, Randy, and I'll be honest. Has there been rancor with these two sides? Of course there's been. And I think we definitely saw that very publicly with what happened when COVID was impacting the entire sport, and these two sides couldn't come to an agreement and never did. Like, to this day, people are like, well, they eventually got it done. I said, no, the Players Association rejected the proposal, and Rob Manfred enacted unilaterally a 60-game season, which is what happened. So I think there's definitely been acrimony with both sides, but I don't think it's personal. Like, I don't think Rob Manfred says, I personally dislike Tony Clark, and Tony says the same about Rob. I just think they're fighting really hard for both sides. You're right about egos, though, and here's where it comes up. The players know the last couple times the owners won. Publicly, privately, whatever you want to talk to, when you look at the deal, you go, okay, the owners won. They're doing pretty well. So the players are like, hey, we got to win one of these things. So that's where you kind of dig in and go, hey, maybe Tony Clark feels like I'm fighting for my job here. I can't just give in here. Nobody wants to lose. And, of course, as Jimmy Hoffa said, you know, life's a negotiation. It's give and take. So the owners can't have the goal of trying to bash the players and beat them. And same thing with the players. They can't feel like, oh, we have to finally demonize these owners and win. What has to happen is some sort of middle ground. But here's where it gets tricky, Randy. What the players really want, the two biggest things, I don't know how they happen. Here's one of them. Free agency. They want to go 6-year reserve period for free agency, which was negotiated by the great Marvin Miller back in 1976. They want 5 years. I can't see that happening. In hockey, it's 7 years until you're a free agent, right? Drafted at 18 until you're 25. So baseball, they want to go from 6 to 5. The owners are not going to give that up. There's no way. I can't see it. The other one is arbitration eligibility to all players with 2 or more years of service. Right now it's 3. So you get drafted, and for 3 years, you're in at the minimum salary, $500,000 a year. Then you go to arbitration. You get paid a lot more money and eventually become a free agent. The players are saying, with some validity, it's a young league. We need to get paid quicker while we're younger. Can we get to free agency quicker? But I can't see the owners bending on those two. Having said that, even if they don't, the owners can say, okay, fine. Minimum salary, let's go from $500,000 to $750,000. That would help, right? One deal the owners are saying is no more draft pick compensation, meaning when you sign a guy, you don't have to give up a pick. So that way, there's more player movement. The owners are proposing a universal DH. That's more jobs, right? More employment. An average DH makes $9.2 million in 2021. So I think that will help. A draft lottery. We have that in the NBA, have that in the NHL. The owners are proposing to do that with baseball. I think those are issues that you can resolve. But you're right about egos. There's no question that does play a part in it.
Adnan Virk, our guest, Major League Baseball, in a lockout after the owners locked out their players this morning. December 1st was the deadline of their collective bargaining agreement. Now, just reading some of the numbers This isn't about the players at the top end of the spectrum so much, Adnan. It's not about, you know, Corey Seager making a mint with the Texas Rangers, you know, $325 million over the course of his contract, or Marcus Semien or any of these guys with the nine-figure deals. Baseball's got almost half of its player contingent making less than $1 million. Now, I didn't realize the minimum salary in baseball was less than it is in the National Hockey League. You know, that's it seems like the players are fighting more for the guys at the bottom of the spectrum than anything else.
Completely, Dan. That's a great point you make. There's a real income parity here. Like, it's real inequality when you look at what the top guys are making. I believe the stat is like 80% of the salaries in baseball, like of the $10.4 billion salary, is from like 30 guys. Like, it's crazy how top heavy it is. But here's where the players have the advantage. Seven of the top eight largest contracts in baseball history, all over $300 million, were signed under this CBA. Trout, Tatis, Harper, Lindor, Cole, Betts, Machado. They also have, just in terms of, you mentioned hockey having a higher minimum salary, but in general, if I said to you guys, what's the best CBA? It's baseball. NFL is the worst, as we all know. There's no guaranteed money. It's horrible. A guy gets hurt, well, tough luck. In baseball, it is guaranteed money. It's the only sport with $300 million guaranteed contracts. There's no salary cap. There's no max on value or length. It's no rights of first refusal. There's no franchise tag like other sports. So the players have all those wins in their pocket. But you're right. When you look at the players overall, there's too many guys who feel like they're getting squeezed. That's why I think the owners will be smart. Raise that minimum level, and that will make those guys who, as you mentioned, feel like they're being underpaid, feeling more valued.
Well, and you know, the larger question too about baseball as well is their reluctance to change the game too much, at least before the CBA. How much of a part of the conversation is potentially making certain tweaks to the game as time goes on, and how much say the Players Association may have in that as time goes on?
Great question, Seth. So that's the biggest thing. I kept saying to myself, all right, if there's a lockout, this is going to impact a lot of people in Major League Baseball, and that's sad to see, and hopefully people don't get furloughed and keep their jobs and we'll get back to business. But if we can make the game a better game, if we got to take a little bit of a pinch right now and all of a sudden the game is in a better spot long term, then maybe that's not the worst thing in the world. But here's the problem. When Rob Manfred was speaking, my understanding is they haven't even gotten to that point. Like, right now, they're just dealing with free agency, arbitration. The players are upset about tanking. Hey, can we get a salary floor, the competitive balance tax? They're worried about that stuff. But you're right. Like, I'm hoping once we get through all that, hey, by the way, can we get a pitch clock? Can we eliminate the shift? Can we talk about ways to speed up the games so that we don't have 3-hour and 50-minute playoff games? Can we get back to 2.5-hour playoff games? Like, is that possible? So I'm with you. I all I've been hearing right now is they're focused on the financial stuff, and I get it. Money's the most important thing that's driving the conversation. But my real prayer and hope is that we get to February 1 and they get the financial stuff done and say, hey, listen, let's make this a better game. The game will always have fans. The game will always have sustainability. But in terms of the overall popularity of the game, the four of us know, you cannot deny, the game is too slow as it's presently constructed. Tom Verducci said to me, there's 29 seconds between pitches. That's too much. It's got to be 20 seconds. Trim the fat. Get the ball and go. Make it 15 seconds. Like that, that will definitely speed things up in a very dramatic way, and I think it would change the sport. In the playoffs, I couldn't even believe this stat. There's like an average of 5 minutes before a ball's put in play. Think about that. The time in between pitches, the number of pitches that are not swung at, balls and strikes and foul balls, every time there's a ball put in play, you got to wait 5 minutes. That's got to change. You got to make the sport more relatable and more palatable for younger fans. And I know the economics are driving this lockout, but hopefully you can worry about making the sport as good as it can possibly be, because in my heart, I still think it is the best sport. It's a sport that I most love, and I care about it deeply.
Final thing on this, Adnan. The players' argument for anti-tanking and trying to implement some things that remove tanking in baseball, I don't really get it. Like, I know that there's some teams that spend a lot less money than others. At the same time, though, baseball's had about as much parity as anybody else in that, you know, what, more than half the league has been to the World Series over the last 10, 15 years?
I'm with you, man. I don't get it either. Like, in a vacuum, I get it. You go, hey, we have to make sure all teams are trying to compete. But that's like saying everyone's trying to win the race and a couple guys got bum legs. Like, there's no way every team thinks they're going to win the World Series every year. That's just not prudent. There's years that you say we're in rebuild mode. So how can you guard against a team in rebuild mode? Because that happens. Like, you shouldn't try to win the World Series every year. Either you try to win it or you're rebuilding to do so. You're acquiring assets. You're paring down salary. You're making trades. And when the moment is not, absolutely, let's go. Like, as you believe, the Blue Jays right now are primed to make a push, and they should. But to your point about parity, I mean, every year you find a different playoff team. It's one of my biggest criticisms of the NBA. I had a cousin visiting from Tampa who went to the Knicks game, outrageously expensive, and we're sitting there, and I said, the Knicks got pumped by like 18. I said, you know, I could have told you that would happen. But there's no chance the Knicks are going to win this game. I look at the records right now, Suns and Warriors and the Nets, and I'm like, Bucks. I'm like, two of these four teams are going to make the playoffs. We all know that. Like, it's so obvious. Whereas in baseball, I don't know one sane person who said the Atlanta Braves are going to win the World Series. No one. I said the Braves are going to lose in the first round. I called Brewers-Rays World Series. There's no sport more unpredictable than baseball's playoffs. And as far as all the players who just got signed, they're all from non-playoff teams. Look at all the money where it was spent. The Texas Rangers spent $500 million. They didn't make the playoffs. The Tigers signed Javier Baez. They didn't make the playoffs. Miami's spending money. The Mets spent a ton of money. They didn't make the playoffs. So I get it if the players said, hey, it's always the Yankees, Red Sox, and Dodgers spending. But it isn't. It's all the teams that didn't make the playoffs. So theoretically, that would create more competitive balance in the league. And by the way, it's all types of players getting paid. Older players, Simeon, Scherzer, who broke the AAV record, $43 million a season, but also middle-tier guys. Avisel Garcia, Eduardo Escobar. Guys of all stripes are getting taken care of.
All right, before we let you go, Adnan, I have to say thank you for inspiring me to eat the decadent chocolate chip cookie pie. I tagged you in that tweet. You inspired me, my friend.
Randy, there's nothing better than a decadent cookie, but you got to have the milk to go with it, right? Like, I have the patience of Job. If somebody offers me an entire box, I say, no, I'm fine. But you get me a glass of milk, and it's go time. And you can't, in the past, I showed some restraint. Each cookie is 85 calories. It's embarrassing that I even know that, because I would look at the side and go, okay, three cookies, 210 calories, it's doable. But now you got to go whole sleeve. I mean, six cookies, that's 480 calories, but that's a good snack. I mean, we've all earned it. You guys are younger and thinner than I am, so you can do it on my behalf. Randy, go wild on those PC cookies.
Oh, yeah. I'm telling you, next time you visit Canada, you got to try the pie. The pie is elite.
Adnan, you have about as much restraint with cookies and milk as the Texas Rangers do in free agents. It's unbelievable.
That might be the best comparison you can make of the day. I am the Texas Rangers of eating cookies. I'm going to use that. That's great, Dan.
Thanks for this, Adnan. We'll talk next week.
Thanks, boys. Be well.
There is Adnan Verk, one of the best. It's funny, baseball spending all this money, and then now it's like, we have no money. The players want too much. Like, what? You just gave them, like, over $1 billion in free agency.
Yeah, help us. Yes. Help us so we don't spend this money going forward.
Exactly.
Like, that's essentially what they're
like,
looking at.
You spend freely, and then you're like, oh, no, I'm actually poor.
Help me.
It's very strange how this always happens, but it happens in all the sports. You know, like we've been through enough lockouts now that we've seen it. It's just about the dollars and cents of it all. I feel for the players in this one, though, because minor league players in baseball have been taken advantage of to the nth degree. Like, it's so bad. You read some of the stories about how they've been treated through the years, and it's just flat out ridiculous. And even reading some of the stats today, you know, baseball for a lot of guys in the league, almost half the league, it's kind of like a freelance sport now. You know, you're coming up, you're going down, you're coming back up, pitch a couple of games, mm-hmm. and you're going down for a week. You come back up, they use you in the pen because they got blown out a couple of times. So it's like, it's a gig league for a lot of guys, you know, so you're not making your minimum salary the whole time. You're making like half of that, or, you know, whatever it may equate to over the course of a season, if you're lucky enough to spend enough days on the major league roster. 50% of the league is making less than $1 million. And I know for most people, that's still a ton of money, and you're playing baseball for that. So what's the big deal? But just to think of the disparity between the top and the bottom, this is all about those guys at the bottom getting a little bit more of the pie.
It comes back to fair market value. When are baseball players at their most valuable? Mid to late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
But when do they actually get paid? 30s, generally, or late 20s, right?
Yeah.
So players, you can understand the fight here. The fight is we are valuable much more earlier. And we've seen it in hockey where you do have a little bit, you know, those coming off the ELCs, players and, you know, agents have worked to make sure that guys get paid earlier.
Well, Pettersson and Hughes, you know.
Classic example.
But the thing in baseball, though, is if you're a highly touted prospect,
yeah,
let's say if you get drafted high, you're getting a big signings bonus. I know it's changed a little bit now, especially when you're paying guys that, you know, are from outside the draft system, whether they're, I mean, you still got to pay the posting fees if you're trying to get somebody from, say, Japan or somebody across the coast there. But if you go down to, like, Cuba, you know, you can't spend as much as you could before, but players also, a lot of players make a lot of money before they even play a single game. In hockey, you don't make, you know, you get a signing bonus. It's not a lot. It's a few hundred thousand. You get millions if you're a good prospect in baseball, right? With your signing bonus and everything like that. So initially there's money. And then when you come through, you're not getting paid a lot until you get to your arb years. And then your arb years kick in. That's when you start making a bit more than ultimately the free agency. I just find it fascinating when you look at baseball's system versus what other sports have. Baseball's is the most reflective of the American economy than any of the other leagues. And I just find that fascinating. And I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I do always find it funny, though, that the capitalists try to be socialists when it comes to the leagues, the sporting leagues. But baseball is the one league that's still very capitalistic in that sense.
And it's a long history as well. If you haven't watched it, Ken Burns' documentary on baseball really breaks it down to the early days. Like, players got a rough ride early. They're making millions now, but it still kind of reflects the dynamic that baseball had in the early, you know, 20th century.
Coming up on the People's Show, Brent Seabrook, interim volunteer assistant coach with the Vancouver Giants. He joins us next on Sportsnet 650.
Now back to the People's Show with Seth, Dan, and Randeep on Sportsnet 650.
The People's Show. Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah, and Randeep Janda. A lot of takes coming in on the lockout. And fans always have, you know, it's tough as a fan when you are just wanting to see these guys play and these types of things. And they're fighting millionaires versus billionaires, as we know. In regards to our conversation of, you know, should leagues worry about being out of the spotlight, we are kind of in an era where the era of mass distraction is what I've seen it called, where you're easily distracted by something else, or you've got a Netflix show that you can watch, or you get lost in TikToks, whatever it may be. And baseball is like the ultimate time sport. You know, it takes forever. As Adnan was mentioning, you know, 5 minutes between balls in play in the World Series. I mean, it's the action just isn't happening anymore. So if there's one worry for baseball specifically, that's probably it. It's just not, it's not really a modern game right now.
No, it's not. And the purists and the, you know, the traditionalists or the hardcore baseball fans that go back a number of years, they are going to be loyal no matter what. How are you attracting that casual? How are you attracting somebody that's never been a baseball fan? And it's not by, you know, not changing anything. And that's something that I think, a couple of things here, where you go forward, the lockout is going to maybe alienate some of those traditional fans, but also you're not tapping into new fans. You're doing the opposite.
Yeah. It's a fascinating conversation, one that will carry on through the course of the winter. It's Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah, and Randeep Janda. We are the People's Show. Now welcoming into the program, Brent Seabrook, Vancouver Giants interim volunteer assistant coach, and of course, former NHLer with the Chicago Blackhawks. Thanks for this, Brent. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Wow, you got a lot of titles there for me. Interim volunteer assistant coach.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like Ron Burgundy. They just, whatever they put on the sheet is what I read.
Perfect.
How are you doing? Are you enjoying hockey back here in the Lower Mainland?
I am. Yeah, I'm not back yet, but last night was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. It was a cool experience for myself. My family was there, and I'm looking forward to getting going.
That's awesome. Now, I do want to get more into your time with the Vancouver Giants and the move into coaching. But first, I wanted to get your take on what happened with your former club, the Chicago Blackhawks, and the situation with Kyle Beach. What was your reaction to the results of the investigation?
My reaction to the results of the investigation? Yeah, I mean, I read it just like a lot of other people did, and I was, yeah, it was tough to read, to be honest. You know, and then watching Kyle's interview the following day, it was obviously tough to see and watch it.
And it was tough to kind of hear about stuff that, you know, at that point, did you know about any of the stuff that happened, or was that a lot of stuff new to you when the investigation came out?
Yeah, I didn't know what was going on. You know, as players, we weren't around the Black Ace as much, but yeah, it was just the whole situation's tough, and you know, I just wish Kyle all the best. You know, I reached out to Kyle and we sent some messages back and forth, but yeah, it's just a tough situation. I hope Kyle's feeling better, and you know, he's been able to sort of get this out in the open and feels better about his decision. So yeah.
You're listening to The People Show. We're joined by Brent Seabrook. He's currently an interim volunteer assistant coach with the Vancouver Giants. And getting into coaching, Brent, if we talk about this opportunity, first of all, how did it come about? How did this, you know, pop up onto your radar?
My agent sort of started it. He's got a good relationship with Scott Bonner, who used to be the GM there in Vancouver. And Scott's, I think, working for Jerry now. And you know, I think as far as that went, it was sort of a quick conversation that me and Jerry had, and he said he was going to pass my number along to Mike Dick, who was actually my junior coach 20 years ago in Lethbridge. He was my first assistant coach as a 16-year-old. So we've stayed in touch a little bit, and he reached out, kicked it around a little bit. I talked to Ron Toigo a little bit. I've got a good relationship with the Toigo family. I grew up in Tawasin and grew up with, you know, one of the many grandchildren of Elizabeth and Ron and all that. And it was just one of those things that, you know, I couldn't sort of pass up on it. I've been trying to think of what I wanted to do in my post-hockey career, and I want to stay in hockey. I just don't know what that is. So, selfishly, it's a free look at coaching, and you know, the main reason why I want to do it, I want to see if I'm any good at connecting with these young players and see if I can do it. So I'm excited for the opportunity.
How was the first night last night?
Different. It's a different look. I'm used to sitting on the bench with my head right on the boards, being able to see everything, and you know, that was tough, sitting behind the players and fighting with Mike Dick and Keith there for room behind there, and trainers walking back and forth, helping right. guys out and tossing sticks. And I actually grabbed a stick and passed it to somebody, so that was cool. but yeah, it was just sort of, it was a different experience for sure. The first period went by super fast. I don't know if I was into it or not, or out of it, just trying to pick up on what the coaches were doing and all that, but you know, I'm just looking forward to getting there. I'm looking forward to see if I can do a good job. I want to try and help these kids out, and I learned a lot as a junior hockey player with the coaching staff that I had, and I'm just trying to help.
Well, and I know it's only one game and just being there, but some of the talent stands out pretty quickly, doesn't it? You see Justin Sordov, you see Fabian Lysell. Like, some of these kids, you see them up close. I know it's only one game, but you're a former player. It's pretty easy to spot the good ones, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I noticed it right away in pregame skate. I was out there for the skate, and I couldn't believe how fast every single player was and how skilled they were. I actually had to get out of the way because I was going to get run over a few times, because as a coach, I don't know where to stand. As a player, I did, but as a coach, I was trying to stay out of the way of the guys, and then I was in a different guy's way. So, yeah, it was a little bit different, but yeah, just some talented young kids, I think, on both teams last night. It was fun to watch how fast they moved the puck. A lot of stuff they can do, I was never able to do as a player, so it's pretty cool.
You're listening to The People Show. We're joined by Brent Seabrook. And Brent, you obviously are a local guy, as you mentioned, the Tawasin connections, but you did play against Vancouver as an arch rival with the Chicago Blackhawks. How does it feel to be coaching a Vancouver-based team now, just with the rivalry with Vancouver for so long?
It's different, I guess. I don't know. It's coaching. I think the whole thing's new to me. I think coaching in Vancouver, it'd be different if I was coaching the Canucks, I think. But the Giants, they always house the kids in my hometown growing up. I'm going to be staying with my parents while I'm doing this. And, I played in the Ladner Rink quite a bit growing up and whatnot. I don't think I've ever been to the Langley Event Center, so that'll be new. But I'm just excited all the way around. It's going to be fun.
So what about coaching interests you as you look for that opportunity in hockey beyond playing?
I think helping the kids. I think a lot of the stuff that I noticed last night, just little things here and there, that when I was, growing up in junior as well as growing up in the NHL, I was taught a lot of that stuff. And, I think you always want to be taught. You're always learning as a player. It doesn't matter if you're, 35 when I retired or if you're 16, and I've learned how to play the game. I feel like a lot of stuff that really helped me was the little things that you might not notice a lot, but it protected me a lot as a player. And I think that's some of the stuff I can bring to it. But, with that being said, I don't know what I'm going to like about coaching. I think that's an opportunity for me to learn. Keith, we spent a little bit of time yesterday together really like his approach. I've got some experience with Mike as a player, so I wish he would have been around a little bit longer, but he's going to do a great job with Canada, so that's great for him. And I'm just trying to learn and see what I like, and maybe there's some things I don't like, but like I've been saying a few times here, I'm excited for the opportunity. So,
what's one thing you wish you knew as a junior player that you learned through? As you were more a veteran in the NHL?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I don't know. I think there's probably things that I wish I worked on more as a junior kid. It might have helped me a little bit better. I think the league changed quite a few times as far as speed, when I was in the NHL. But I don't know. That's a tough question to put my finger on it. I think... I had a great coach in junior with Mike and Brian Maxwell. They taught me a lot of little things, helping out and whatnot. But yeah, I can't pinpoint one thing that I wish I learned. Not saying that I didn't learn anything in NHL. I learned a ton, but I can't pinpoint it.
Well, it was a busy week for Chris Russell. He ended up breaking your record for block shots in NHL history, so he topped 2,000. You held that record for a little bit. The role as a shot blocker, and we're seeing the importance of that here in Vancouver after Alex Edler left and Chris Tanev, but what makes someone a good shot blocker? Is it like part skill, part you got to be a little crazy as well, Brent?
Yeah, I don't know if crazy is the right word. I think just the willingness to do it. I think you see there's guys that do it all kinds of different ways. You can sprawl out and, do it. You can just cut off lanes. You can just be in that spot. Just the willingness to put a leg out there, put a knee down, lay down as some forwards do at the point. Just trying to make yourself big and the willingness to get hit by that puck. I think there's players in the game that have that. And they're not that they're afraid. They go on it without thinking, and there's some guys that don't like to get hit by pucks, but the guys that are hard to get your shots through on and stuff like that, they just seem to be able to do it. Maybe a little crazy, like a goaltender. Most goalies are crazy, so most guys that block off the shots might be a little bit off, but
well, I'm sure, I don't know, I'm not sure if you've heard, but the Canucks have struggled this year, especially on the PK. And, you know, and one of the things that we kind of see is there's conversations about personnel or what's going on. But from your perspective, as a defenseman who was an elite level penalty killer, what one thing were you thinking about more than anything when you're trying to prevent goals against? Like, what was the one thing? Was it trying to take an angle away, trying to block a shot, the stick in the right spot? Like, what was the one thing you focused on more than anything when you were on the PK?
It changes. I think you're always changing. I think, you know, when different power plays are coming in, I know when you play Ovechkin, you're trying to take that shot away, not give him that. But then, you know, they got such a potent power play and so many different weapons that it's hard. You got to sort of, you know, pick your poison on that one. I know when we played Nashville a lot, we try and shade to Weber and let the other four guys beat us. So it'd sort of be a 4-on-3 on half the ice. You know, so as a defenseman, you know, you're trying to, I don't really know what you're trying to think about. You're trying to cut off lanes. You're trying to get in lanes. You're trying to tie up sticks. You know, you got to let your goaltender see the puck so he can make the first save. And then as defenseman, it's our job to get the rebound out and help him. You know, whether he's got to make a second save, we're trying to push that out. If we can get it and clear it, or we can get it and give it to a forward or something like that, that's the ultimate goal. But, yeah, I think as far as, I'm not going to analyze the Canucks power play. I haven't watched it very much, but, penalty kill. But, yeah, I think as defenseman, you got lots of different things you're thinking about depending on the unit you're playing against, for sure.
Brent, we really appreciate the call today, and maybe we'll get in a little bit deeper on some hockey talk next time around. Thanks for this.
All right, you got it. Thanks, guys.
There is Brent Seabrook, currently coaching with the Vancouver Giants as an assistant on a volunteer basis, and joining us here on the People's Show.
I love how he said, yeah, there's no element of crazy to be a penalty killer and a shot blocker, and then he ends off saying, yeah, maybe there's a little bit of crazy.
Maybe there's a little
crazy involved.
Well, you got to be willing to block those shots. And you know, I do find it interesting, though, because what a lot of defensemen will tell you is, yeah, you're trying to block shots and all that sort of stuff, but it's more about trying to take a lane away,
yeah,
right? And sometimes you take the lane away and the shot doesn't come off, and that's as good as a block shot because you've taken away the opportunity for the player to get that shot off, right? So more than anything, what you got to do is take those lanes,
yeah,
right? And that's ultimately what the best guys do. They don't just focus on, okay, I'm just trying to block this shot. It's like, okay, whatever you do to get in the way, whether it's your stick, body positioning. And, you know, when we look at the Canucks penalty kill,
yeah,
they have such a hard time taking lanes away, right? That's, you just see it open up constantly.
And especially in, you know, I don't like going back into the past too much, but with Alex Edler, there's a lot of things he couldn't do.
Yeah.
You know, skating and that movement was an issue, being, you know, getting caught in the neutral zone and sticking out his knee, and the patented Alex Edler trip in the neutral zone was becoming a thing. But one thing he did really well was getting in those lanes. He'd plug up those lanes where you didn't want to take that shot because Alex Edler's there. You'd have that stick there, which would, you know, mess up the passing lanes. And that's one area that they have missed Alex Edler, is that, sure, foot speed may not be there. He's not a guy that you want pinching because he's not going to be able to get back. But those shooting lanes on the PK and those passing lanes, nobody's clogging them up, and he used to be able to do that.
It's you see it often with the Canucks power play, where Pettersson will wind up for the one-timer, but then he'll not take it. It's because he's seeing that the lane is gone. His area or his look for the goal, he doesn't see it anymore, so he's not going to take that shot, and he's going to recalibrate, see if there's a better look that they can get on the power play. Now, I think he hasn't been willing enough to just take the shot sometimes, which is what you have to do, but it is so much about the lane, and that's why we talk about Ovechkin so much, because he gets his shot off so many different ways at so many different angles and always seems to know how to get it on net.
Yeah.
Even when a lane may be slightly taken away. And we see that a little bit with Oliver Ekman-Larsson, who has a real good natural ability to have a vision of just how to get the puck through bodies and towards the net.
Yeah, I mean, on that, you know, defensemen can just find a way to get pucks through. And I found Kevin Bieksa to be that way. Kevin Bieksa didn't have a rifle, But he just knew how to get the puck through. And there were some years where he was a quarterback on the power play, not elite level, but he put up good points. The power plays were humming because he just knew how to get those pucks through. Decent passes over to the Sedins, but more than anything, he knew how to get that shot through to keep the defense honest as well. And, you know, it's really interesting watching the Canucks and how they kill penalties and what Brent mentioned about how against every single different power play, you do something different. Now, I'm not saying the Canucks aren't trying to game plan against your opponent. They do. But it doesn't look like they look different against opponents. You know what I mean?
It's like a cookie-cutter approach for everything.
It's like
it
every
feels
game.
Like it.
It feels like it. Every game, they're doing the same type of thing. And sometimes it works, and more often than it shouldn't, it doesn't work, right? And I don't know how much of that is instruction or how much of that is personnel, right? But obviously, the Canucks don't have good penalty killers. But I also just wonder, you know, are you getting your matchups the way you want them?
And that's a valid point. And, you know, yesterday we look at the PK. And what I like to see, actually, and it was, you know, the Tyler Mott element, was that they were aggressive on the forecheck on the PK, which is something that Mott brings. They give up that one goal to the Ottawa Senators on the power play. Yeah, sure, you know, you're functioning at a 80% clip for the rest of the game, which is fine. But there was some aggression, which was nice to see, because you haven't seen that so much from the Canucks this year. And maybe that's the element that Tyler Mott brings over time. Hopefully the rest of the squad gets that, but it was, at least from a positive perspective, there was actually pressure in the defensive zone, and you're saying, where has that been all year? So hopefully as time goes on, you see a little bit more of that from Tyler Mott and some other players where they're not just a sponge absorbing pressure in their own zone.
It's the Canucks and Penguins on Saturday. We'll see how they carry with this two-game win streak. Hope to have Brian Burke tomorrow on the People's Show, so be tuning in for that president with the Pittsburgh Penguins. Coming up, Irfan Gafar, fourth period, he'll join us. What the future is continuing to develop into for this Canucks team and more. Plus, still have a pair of tickets to give away for the Canucks and LA Kings December 6th. Be tuning in for that. It's the final hour of the People Show next on Sportsnet 650.